Mitzvah Reish Chaf Hei, 225. Shelo nechachesh al mamon sheyesh la'acher b'yadeinu. We shouldn't deny that somebody else has money in our possession. Shelo nechachesh b'mash shehufkad b'yadeinu
v'chol mash... Money in our possession?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Let's say you lend me $500 and I have to pay you back. So somebody says, do you owe Mrs. Hirsch $500? And I say, no. That's the vimachish. That's to deny that you have somebody else's money in your possession. Or if you give me a gold watch, and I say, where's my gold watch? I want it back. What gold watch? That's what we're talking about. Anything else that we have of someone else that's in our possession, you shall not deny. So the received explanation is that it's talking about money that's, it doesn't just mean deny anything. It means specifically money that somebody you owe somebody else, you have to give back to someone else, and you deny having it. V'loshon Sifra, the halachic medrash and Sefer Baker says, L'vishon Emar, v'chichesh bav v'nishbal sheker. It also says that if you deny it and then you swear falsely, l'madnu onesh. So we said that if you swear falsely, then you deny that you have somebody else's money in your possession. So you have to bring a korban, etc. L'madnu onesh. We learn a punishment as har minayin, but we don't have any verse that says explicitly that you're not allowed to do it. So that's where our parsha comes in. This verse right here. Lo sechachashu ish ba'amiso, you're not allowed to deny. Tamalomar v'lo sechachashu. Gamzos, min ha-mitzvah sha'seichel meyed bahena. This is also one of the mitzvahs that, even if God hadn't told us to do it, it's self-understood that in order for society to function, so people can't be denying other people's money. You have to be honest with your business dealings, and therefore you have to do it. Medinei ha-mitzvah, halachazor, as follows, ma'ash'amiz rechonim levracha, sha'kofer bepikadon pasul le'edus. That even if you don't go around stealing people's money outright, but if somebody else's money is by you, in colloquial terminology, if it's in your possession, then you deny it, then you have become invalidated to serve as a witness. Even if you don't take a shvua, you might think that, well, if you took a shvua, an oath about it, and then you were found to, the shvua was found to be false, so then obviously you're pasul eidos, you're pasul for shvuas, you're not allowed. If anybody has a court case against you, they're going to win because you've been established yourself to be a completely unreliable person. No, b'amru b'gemara here, even it's saying in a case even over here that you didn't end up taking a shvua about the money that you owe someone else, but you just deny owing it. Say no, I don't owe it. Even though no oath is involved, you still pasul eidos. B'amru b'gemara. So, what do you mean? If you don't have to take an oath, and just because you deny it, so maybe you have a semi-legitimate reason. Maybe I lost Mrs. Hirsch's gold watch, and I need some time to order a custom replacement from Switzerland, and I'm just buying myself time. I have every intention of returning a gold watch to Mrs. Hirsch. And I say, you know what? Oh, I don't have it. So that's semi-true, even though you really should be honest about the whole thing. It could be that it's not in your possession at that very time. That's why witnesses have to come and say, no, at the time that you took the oath, so that item was in your possession. You knew about it. You knew that you could have given this person the money back or the object back right away. It's explained in Maseches Shavuos, the Tractate of Oaths. V'noeg is v'zeh b'chol makom u'v'chol zman v'zchar menekevos. It applies to both males and females. V'yover alev v'chichesh v'amiso b'dover shebemamon over alav zeh. If you do it, you violate this negative commandment. V'huka over al mitzvah smelech aval ein bo malkos. So you violated what God said to do, and you're a very bad person in this situation, but you do not receive the penalty of lashes because the lav she'in bo maisa. That when just speaking about something, denying that you owe money, has no action associated with it, so therefore you're not liable to the penalty of lashes, which is generally, though not always, as we'll see in a few minutes, reserved for a lav she'yesh bo maisa. It has to have a real action associated with it, excluding beliefs, words, that even though speaking is an action, it's not considered an action for this purpose. Mitzvah Reish Chavav, 226. Shelo lishava al kviras mamon. Shelo nishba, so we shouldn't take an oath. It's an additional level of prohibition to what we just discussed when you deny the possession or owens of money. Shelo nishba al ha'achasha, so we shouldn't take a vow about denying. Shenemar velo seshakru, you shall not lie. Kilomar shim kafar ish bikadon avar al lo sechachashu. That, I know, there's a general issue with lying in the Torah.
Yeah, I mean, you can't think of obviously swear falsely is already is usher.
Right, it adds an additional level of prohibition. Yeah. You're right, because we have repetitions of ideas in the mitzvahs all the time. Even though you're not allowed to lie, except for the certain cases to bring shalom, or if somebody what are the three that if somebody asks about. First of all, in order to bring shalom, in order to make peace between people, as we were discussing in the drasha last week, that Aaron HaKohen, according to these midrashic sources that discuss the stories about what he did to bring peace between people, so in that it involved lying. He said, two people had a fight, so Aaron said, this went to one person and said, the other guy really wants to make peace with you, and he went to the opposite guy and said, that guy, just came to me begging me to try to make peace, and he said how wrong he was, but he was too embarrassed to approach you directly. So, okay, there you go. So they made peace, but that involved lying.
But then both of them will be angry at Aaron, so that's, it's a great improvement, I'm sure, when they find
out. If it turns out.
Yeah,
but before they find out, they'll be so happy in their newfound peace that they'll forgive him.
I would not recommend this.
That's one category.
There's different interpretations, but if somebody asks you if you learned a particular masechta, mm-hmm. so you're allowed to say no in terms of modesty. And if somebody asks you about what?
It's not lying.
It is lying, but you're allowed to do it anyway. If somebody says, "Did you learn? Have you learned all of Shas?" And maybe you have learned all of Shas. But don't say no. I really haven't. No, you're allowed to. You don't have to. I know. Obviously, it's wrong. If you see in this situation that if there's
somebody's looking for an expert.
Right, if there's an emergency shaila that you have to answer and there's no one else to do it and you say, no, I don't know the answer, and you really do, so that's not publicly. Also, you're allowed to lie if somebody asks you questions about your intimate relationships, then you're allowed to, you don't have to give answers.
Vim nishba
al hakfira achar kach, but specifically in this case it's referring to in this way, when it says losh shakar in this case, and not midvar sheker terchak, the prohibition of lying in general is generally derived from midvar sheker terchak, distance yourself from any falsehood, as opposed to here where it says losh shakar, where it's the received tradition is that it's talking about the shavua, the oath regarding denying that you have to give someone else money. So you violate two negative commandments. If you first deny, then you take an oath, you don't have to give someone else money. So the received tradition of this verse is, like I said, it's only talking about, it's really talking about the Shua. What is it telling you? Lamadnu onesh. Since it says another place, nishbal sheker, so sheker. It's used, lying is used in the two times over here, so it sounds like she's talking about Yeshua. Asar minayin tam lomar velos shakru. So I'm sorry. So nishbal sheker means telling you the penalty that you have to bring a certain korban, and here it's telling you you're not allowed to do it by saying velos shakru. But his barba masech Yeshuas. It says in Tractate Shua, Shekol Misha Yishava Shua Sheker Al Kviras Mammon over Bishnei Lavin. You violate two negative commandments. As we just said, Mishum Velos Yishavu Bishmila Sheker, or Mishum Velos Yishakur Yishba Miso. So two things, really, I'm sorry. Right. So like Charlie pointed out before, so you're not allowed to take a false oath anyway. So one is that you're not allowed to, in general, the prohibition of taking a false oath, and specifically a false oath about denying you owe someone else money is an additional level of prohibition. Why are you not allowed to take a false oath? Obviously, it breaks down the court system. So, the court system won't work when people owe each other money, or any have to take a shua regarding a court case they have with someone else, and they swear falsely, and also is a denigration of the name of God, because when you take a shua, you mention the name of God. Or it's on a sefer Torah.
What's
it's not really done anymore. The only times that Ashua Daraisa is routinely done in Bezdin is actually when you have someone who's a shliach to deliver a get. So when someone's a shliach to deliver a get, they say, part of the nusach is that they accept upon themselves as a chirim and bind themselves with Ashua Daraisa, that they will not nullify the agency. So in other words, you could go in front of, in theory, if someone's a shliach to deliver a get, you could go in front, on the way you're to deliver the get to this woman, or even, let's say, What's done a lot of times is the shliach will stand in front of a bezdin, which is the mechanism you need to do something like this. The shliach, the first shliach, is generally just someone who works at the bezdin, or it's oftentimes a sofer, will stand in front of a bezdin, and let's say the get is written in New York and needs to be delivered in Chicago. So you stand in front of the bezdin and say, I, so-and-so, was designated by the husband to deliver this get to his wife, but he also gave me permission that if I want, I can appoint a sub-agent or another agent or a whole chain of agents until the get reaches his wife's hand. So I hereby, in front of you, the bezdin, declare that so-and-so is such a person in Chicago is going to be the next in the chain of shlichim to deliver the get to the wife, and usually doesn't go more than two agents. But then he says, but in theory, after that, even after that's done, and the get's in the hand of the other agent in Chicago, and he's about to deliver it to the wife, so the first shliach, in other words, all the shlichim has to be a chain. Once, well, there's a break in the chain, so there's no more shlichas in the get, if the get reaches the wife's hand, so she will not be divorced. So in theory, the first agent could go in front of two witnesses and say, two witnesses, I hereby declare that I nullify my agency. And therefore, that breaks the chain, since he's not a shliach. The next guy's shlichas depends on the fact that the first guy was made a shliach by the husband. So therefore, that we have the person who's a shliach take a shuah deraisa, so that he's not going to nullify the agency. Otherwise, that would cause a lot of problems.
Wait, but the husband could also nullify the get, you know, before it reaches the wife, couldn't he?
So also say shuah deraisa. I mean, some husbands are not... the shliach, hopefully, they're all Orthodox Jews. And they take a shuah deraisa, they are going to be shaking in their boots to violate it, but... the husband's not always so religious. He says, I accept upon myself a ban and buy biblical oath. Yeah, so that would cause a lot of problems. So in other words, the husband usually doesn't know what he's saying. If he's not a, you know, reshiva trained. So, okay, so he says this. So he doesn't know how to be mevatalit either. So, okay, so he binds himself by an oath not to nullify it. So it's not, oh, he's really not going to do it. Not because he really believes in the oath, although hopefully he respects his word, but because he doesn't even know how to nullify it. But sometimes you have serious problems where there are stories where the husband has said, you know, I don't care about your oath, and maybe he had some yeshiva training, and he's not religious anymore, and he goes and in nullifies.
Yeah,
that's a problem. Mishor sheYisra shvuah lesheker kosafti beparshas vayishma Yisro besimin lamed beis. Okay, that's fine. Vendine hamitzvah zo beperik chamishi mishvus. The halachos are found in the fifth paragraph of Masechet Shavuos, and rekes b'chol makom v'chol zman, all places and all times. Over alev v'shiker v'nishba l'kvira b'mezid loke. If you did it on purpose, you knew it was usher, and you knew you weren't supposed to do it, then you receive the penalty of lashes. The afalpi shein b'maisa, t'lav shein b'maisa, mechomer ashvuach yivatu atorah malkos. So since the ashvuach, even though it's only speech, still the Torah says you get malkos for it because the prohibition of taking an invalid shavua is so great that you receive the penalty of malchus anyway. Right, so not everybody agrees with this, actually. This is the Chinuch's opinion, but there are, quotes the Rambam is saying, that this is not agreed to by all. Nevertheless, hopefully we won't encounter it, so we won't have to determine whether you get malchus now, plus we don't get malchus nowadays anyway. Mitzvah Reish Chav Zayin, Mitzvah 227, Shelo Nishav Al HaSheker. Oh, so now we get into the general prohibition of taking a false oath. Shelo Nishav Al HaSheker, not to take a false oath, Shenemar, Velo Sishavu Bishmi LaShaker, you shall not take an oath in my name falsely. Uperisho Zichronam Levracha, Shezeh Kosuv Yazir Al Shuas Bitoy. This pasuk is talking about Shuas Bitoy. You know, the Torah says, it's just a certain type of shua is to express with your lips either to do good or bad. So what does that mean? This was in the previous, this was in early, in Parshas Tzav, I think. There are four types of shuas bitui. Shtayim lahaba u'shtayim l'she'avar. Two for the future and two for the past. Kigon shenishbal davar she'avar shenasa lo nasa. Let's say you express something that happened in the past. Either you take an oath that it happened or it didn't happen. Well, davar she'asid liyo she'yasa oso liyasa. Take an oath that either you're going to do something or you're not going to do something. Ve'ein shuas bitoy noheges el bidvarm she'efshelo la'adam la'asosan. So the entire institution of this type of shua is only in something that it's in your power to do. Bein l'shavar, bein l'haba l'shavar, whether futurely or pastly. Keitzad l'shavar, achalti o lo achalti, you take an oath that you ate something or you didn't eat something. Chen zarakti o lo zarakti evin layam, that you've thrown a stone into the ocean or not thrown a stone into the ocean. Becheitzad l'haba, ochal o lo ochal, I'm going to eat something, I'm not going to eat something. O ezrok, I'm going to throw the stone into the sea, or I'm not going to throw the stone into the sea. Aval bidvarim sheyeshu en monea min haTorah ein shu hazbitoi no hegeswen. But this institution is not applicable regarding something that's subject to a Torah prohibition. Shein eshu achala ella al davar harish dvar harishus shim ratza useyo im ratza lo usey yaseyo. That this type shu hazbitoi is again laharau lehitiv. That's something where it's in your power either to do good or to do bad. But here, even though technically you have the ability to do it, but you really, it's not officially within your power to do. If you say, let's say I'm going to blow shofar, take an oath that you're going to blow shofar, that's not subject to a shuas bitoy, even though it's your choice whether you do that or not. It has to be something where it's really al pi Torah, your choice whether to do it or not. Lefikach ein chov hazbitoy chal ala bein la'aba l'shavar, gion shenishba l'kayim mitzvah v'lo kiyama. V'cheinim nishba shekiyam mitzvah v'hu lo kiyama. If you, let's say, you were in the hospital over Pesach and you couldn't eat matzah, so you took a shvua that you ate matzah last Pesach. So that's an incorrect shvua. But it's not a shvua hazbitoy because it wasn't within your, it was something that's subject to our Torah rule. V'chmo she'ein chiyuv chal b'da dvar mitzvah l'aba, kach ein ochal ala l'shavar. So just like it doesn't work for the future, so it doesn't work for the past, and that's what it seems from the Gemara in Shavuos. So why is he telling you that's what it seems from the Gemara in Shavuos? Because this ruling is against the ruling of the Rambam. Because the Rambam says, based on the Gemara in Shavuos, that there's a machlokas in the Gemara over there. This is the exact machlokas between Rav and Shmuel. That Shmuel says that whether, when it comes to a mitzvah, whether past or future, it doesn't matter, it's still not a shvuas bitoy. Whereas Rav says that the past is even if it's a mitzvah, so it does fall under shvuas bitoy, because it's done already. So in other words, you can't affect your choice in the future, because you're supposed to make the right choice and do what the Torah tells you to do, but in the past, it's not subject to that. So according to Rav, which is how the Rambam paskins, why? Because we have the normal rule in the Gemara when there's machlokas between Rav and Shmuel. So we go like Rav when it comes to prohibitions, and we go like Shmuel when it comes to legal rulings in terms of court type procedures. So here, seemingly, we should go like Rav. That's where the Rambam paskins. But the Sefer HaChinuch over here, the way he presents it is the opinion of Shmuel. So he clearly feels that from the Sugya and Shavuos, it comes out that we should pass on like the opinion of Shmuel, which is not clear at all from the way, if you would just read the Sugya and Shavuos, that's how it comes out. However, our handy-dandy notes over here, in the fancy edition I have, points out that in the commentary of Rabbeinu Chananel on the Sugya, he seems to have a different gear, so Rabbeinu Chananel seems to say that we should go like Shmuel. So that's what the Sefer HaChinuch is coming with over here, that different reading in the Sugya that makes it clear that we pass like Shmuel in this case. Uminatam azeh shomarnu, from this reason that we said she'ein chiyuv hashvua chal ela b'mashu b'rishuso la'asos. Patru zichron levracha gam kein v'shvuas bitui kol anishva l'hara la'achirim. So another thing that's not subject to shvuas bitui is if you take a shvua that you're going to cause damage to someone else. Since mipnei shu mitzuva shlo la'ara l'chaviru, that's part of the Torah as well. And so it's interesting here, he says patru zichronim levracha. That's not a rule to Rabbanan, but it's that they apply this principle as well, that even though it's not, maybe you'll think an explicit ritual Torah prohibition, nevertheless, if you take a vow to do harm to others, so then you is a shvuas bitoy. I'm sorry, it's not a shvuas bitoy. The chazav ram zichron lebracha, akiyira lo shu lokya mikol makom mishum shvuas shav. But in that case, you will still have a problem of shvuas shav, which is the general prohibition of taking that we learned about in the Ten Commandments. That a shvuas shav means, it's a different type of wrong shavua. There are a few different categories. But a shavua shav is if you take a vow that's obviously false or obviously true. Right, exactly. So
to do with you.
If you say that If you take a vow that the sun is green, that's a shvua shav. If you take a vow that the sun is yellow, or whatever color the sun is, golden, yellow, bright, whatever, so then that's also a shvua shav, even though one's true and one's not true. It's not supposed to be subject to a shvua, something that's so obviously true. So if you take a vow that you're going to cause damage to yourself, you're not allowed to cause damage to yourself. Because it's not as high a level of prohibition as causing damage to others. That's why they talk about this, a whole discussion as to whether you're allowed to have plastic surgeries or all these types of elective things that causes damage to yourself.
Because you're wounding yourself.
Oh, well, there's a wound that comes first, and then you hopefully get the improvement. Although it's not necessarily true that the improvement is going to be exactly the way you wanted it to be.
Heart surgery.
That's a real sakana. That's for real medical purposes. But something I'm talking about something that's totally elective.
Nose job.
Right.
So is
there any consensus about it?
Wait, motion was generally
for shidduchim. It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm semi-joking.
No,
a lot of people.
I'm not joking.
That some people, some post-game are generally do not allow it. But if it's causing difficulty in shidduchim,
do you really want to be married to a guy who cares that much about your damn nose? I mean, really? Okay, you're gonna have to take that off. But really?
I mean, I wouldn't put it in such stark terminology, I would say.
I understand
that when you go on a date with someone, so there are a lot of factors that contribute to whether you want to go on a date again.
I know women where it matters to the woman. She feels as if she's
a
boy. That's
I totally get it.
Right, really, you should go to therapy, which is for sure mutter, according to the Torah.
It's more expensive.
Yeah?
What?
Especially.
Right, so that would be the better thing, but assuming that you need to have the physical change in order to get to the goal.
But men are never allowed to, right?
I wouldn't say never. I don't know. There's a situation where he's really...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, why? Well, you mean because of Begadisha?
No. I thought it was even a question with braces, because you're really not supposed to. That's what Dr. Gutman said.
Braces? Not supposed to have braces?
Whether a boy can do major, you know...
But
braces is not...
You're not
a wound. It's causing a little discomfort.
You have to pull out teeth and stuff. No. Where you are really reshaping. Like when Rachel had braces, it was fine, but she had to have multiple teeth removed to make everything fit in the jaw.
That's
a real refuah, because your teeth, if you don't have them, if they're not properly aligned, they're more likely to fall out. I don't know.
They're not working properly.
No?
I don't know, I just said that. He said that that's what Breuer's said to him.
That no boys should have braces?
No, that it was a question with boys, that with girls...
I never heard of any problem with getting braces at all.
But you have heard of the problem of plastic surgery
with
guys. All right, so it's just an extension.
Right, but I'm saying if it causes him real discomfort real...
Suppose a guy has a horrendous birthmark. I'm thinking of somebody. And if there's a way to fix it,
psychological pain is also something to be taken into account in halacha. But if a man is just a little vain and he wants to have a nose job, is not having any problems in shidduchim because of this or any major life impact, then that would be more of a problem. I mean, I'm not saying it'd be great for a woman either, but for women, I think it's more likely justifiable that she could say for shidduchim. Again, I don't think it's right. I'm not offering my sociological commentary. I'm just saying that the way the world works, so...
Guys wearing makeup on TV.
Well, that makeup is not to make you look better. It's just to make the cameras...
To make it don't look awful, you know.
Right. It's just for the cameras. It's not because you bet some you need to apply it to look good. Okay. Not practical. If anybody has a shiloh, if they need to get plastic surgery for any reason, we're not going to pass it based on what we just said. We have to ask it each individual case to itself.
Exactly.
Fine. So if you have take a shvua to do ill to yourself, so you are, it is a shvua spitoy. Nishba lehitev lacherim bedover shubiyadu lasos v'loso chayim mishum shvua spitoy. But to do good to others, so that is allowed. So that is subject to shvua spitoy, but it's not an explicit mitzvah per se for each type of action that you're going to do. So therefore, it is a shvua spitoy.
What if you're doing good? Let's say that you take a shvua about giving tzedakah.
If that's an explicit thing, but if you say, "Oh, I'm going to give someone a present," there's no specific Torah obligation to give that person a present, therefore that would be a shvut isbuto, again, subject to your desire.
I swear, and then...
V'yesa rube prate hashuas, there are a lot of details about shuas. Vinyan hetera, and how do you get released from a shua? Basically the same idea as how you get released from a neder, which is you go to a panel of three judges, or you go to a chacham mumche, one person who's a real expert in the laws of shuas, and you say, I'm in a different life situation right now. If I had known where in the position I'd be in right now, and I had taken the shua, I never would have taken the shua, and then they matter you.
What's the difference between a shua and a neder? Become a shua for the future and a neder. What's the distinction here?
Shvua is an iser gavra, that it's on the person, and a neder is an iser cheftza, that's on the object. So a shvua, you can take a shvua to do anything. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. I did X, Y, and Z. You can take a shvua about anything in the world. Mm-hmm. But a neder is talking about an object.
Right.
That you say...
Wine is forbidden to me.
Right, wine is forbidden. I asser my possessions on you. I asser your possessions on me. I asser this, you know, type of object on myself.
Okay.
Neither is good. Is bar hakol...
So if you
in
say,
general, yeah.
I'm going to do something. I'm going to run an errand for you.
If you say, I will never drink wine, then that's a shvua. If you say, I asked for wine to myself, then that's another.
But if you do something that's really a shvua, and then you say, pli neder, does that work?
Pli neder and pli shvua only works when a thing really isn't a shvua, just to emphasize the fact that it's not a neder. So, for example... Well, colloquially, I mean, people don't think it must have a difference between a neder and a shua, even though there is. But bli neder doesn't work if you take a shua, then you say bli shua. Bli neder works if you say you're going to do something, and ordinarily that potentially might constitute a neder. If you do it and have it's a good deed and you have intention to continue that good deed, then you might be stuck with a neder. But that's when bli neder works, when there's something that's on the fence. Not when you actually take a neder and say blue neder. You say this. People have extended it to any time you pledge to do something moderately good, so people say blue neder.
You say basic okay? You say blue neder, right?
Right. You can say blue neder, but it really is talking about like if you say something like, you know, I'm going to stop eating. I'm going to start only eating pas yisrael, something like that. So then you say, if you don't say blineder and you, yes, but I'm saying if you pledge to start doing a good thing and you don't, and you, even if you don't say explicitly neder and you do it and you have intention to continue doing it, then that could potentially constitute a neder halachically, even though it's not actually, you don't actually say, I swear, I this object, I asser on myself or whatever it is. So that's why you say blineder. Basically.
It means don't hold me to this in case something comes up.
Right, that's why if you ever want to stop doing it, so if you say, I'm only going to eat Pas Yisrael Bli Neder, then if you're doing it for 15 years, if you outright from the outset you said that this practice was Bli Neder, so if you're doing it for 15 years, still you can stop anytime you want without Hatar Sandarim.
If you do it for 3 meals.
If you do it for a certain amount of time, exactly, when it's a negative type of thing like that, so I don't remember the exact details of how much you have to do it, but if you do it with the intention of continuing, then... Even if you, right, you could be stuck with it, really, as a neder, and you have to have a proper ataras nedarim.
So if you're going to just change, a minhag, let's say, you know, you've always davened nusach sfar, and you go to some place where, you know, there aren't any shuls, that, you know, you have to switch to Ashkenaz or something like that, you need ataras nedarim or something like that, or is that just...
No, because Alpi
Din... Of course, most of the people should have been davening Ashkenaz anyway.
Okay, you're from Moshe Dikiyad, okay. But since halachically, again, what people should or shouldn't be doing in terms of you know, people who have Hasidic ancestry, but now they have nothing to do with Hasidus, why they should be davening Nusach Svar, that's an excellent point.
Yeah.
That's what Charlie is exactly his point. But strictly halachically speaking, there's no difference between Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Svar. You don't say davening whether you daven Nusach Ashkenaz or Nusach Svar. So therefore, that you're allowed, if you're in a situation where you're allowed or want to switch, then you would not have to have Hatar Sadarim because there's no... It's the same level halachically. You only need Hatar Zadarim when you want to go down a notch.
Okay, so if you decide you're going to eat kabrochs then, or something like that, that already is,
Right, so that's a shaila, that if you... It's a very complicated... When exactly a minag that you start doing has the status of a neder or not. Rabbi Simon wrote a big book on it recently. That came out, I think, last year. That talking about minag in terms of halacha. But basically... If you, if you just don't eat gebrucht because you lived in your father's house and your family doesn't eat gebrucht, so then when you establish your own household, you get married and you come to first Pesach you're making yourself and you don't want to keep gebrucht. So assuming gebrucht is not something that's binding on each subsequent generation, which we generally assume that it's not. So then you say, all right, I'm not going to follow this minhag of not eating gebrucht. So therefore, you don't need hatar zedarim because you never took it on yourself. You only did it because that's what was served in your parents' house. But if you did it for a couple of years by yourself, mm-hmm. when you had the choice about the matter, then you might need hatar zedarim. Rav Soloveitchik famously said, you don't need hatar zedarim. Also, yeah, for not eating gebrucht because he also is very shtarka litvak, and he thought the whole thing was what we call a minag betos. Mm-hmm. So if there's something that's simply a mistake, let's say you were doing something for years and years and years and years because you thought it was usur, and then somebody says to you, you know, you're really allowed to do that. And you look in the Shulchan Aruch and says, that's allowed. There's not a question about it. If there's a minority shita that it's not allowed, so you could argue that you were following that minority shita, but if it was just totally, or maybe if you even in that situation, since you didn't know that, so maybe that wouldn't be subject to a neder either. But if it's just, you just made a mistake, so you don't need hataras nedarim. Hataras nedarim, when you make a neder, it means you know something is just a chumra, or just an additional level of prohibition, and you did it anyway. You chose to do it voluntarily. But if you made a mistake, or it was just because it was an ancestral practice, you have to, there's no maseches minhagim in the Gemara, unfortunately. They know exactly what to do. It's very, very few statements of Chazal. It's the beginning of the fourth parak of Maseches Psachim is where it really discusses minhagim. And really in halacha, this is a common misconception that people have, but really in halacha, the concept of minhag is minhag ha-makom. It's local minhag, that if there's a certain established practice in the community, then you have to follow it, even if you're from a different community. The binding nature of family ancestral customs is... it might be mentioned in the Gemara over there according to certain interpretations, but the binding nature of such things are, if they exist at all, is on a much, much lower level than local customs.
So for example, if there's a certain, you know, minhag that if you shake hands, that constitutes a Kenyan or something. You know, in other words, a business practice or something like that would be like the sort of...
Right, hakol keminhag ha-medina. That's not even talking about ritual Jewish things. Yeah. We're talking about general transactions, that's sort of by its nature subject to what's the generally accepted practice in that area.
What is not eating dairy in the 9 days in terms of...
It meat?
Meat,
you mean?
Meat. Yeah. I'm sorry, eating dairy.
Dairy is not a few things they let you eat that...
Is that a minhag hamokom? Is that because I just read that it's absolutely stated that
well
one can eat up until the Sunday before Tisha B'Av, eat meat.
The minhag not to eat meat during the 9 days is a strong minhag that was accepted by large swaths of Klal Yisrael, I think, with the exclusion of Yemenites, maybe, and even nowadays, perhaps they do too.
I just read that the Rambam said that.
No, the Mishnah says explicitly that if you that you're only not allowed to eat meat and drink wine in the Suda Mafsekes before Tisha B'Av.
Yeah.
According to the Dina de Gemara, so that's the only thing that's allowed. It's extended. It was the later Minhagim extended it to the beginning of the 9 days.
And what is that now?
But that is binding because that's not an individual family practice. Oh, I just do this because my father did this. This is the whole practically the whole Jewish world, and certainly it's been reestablished as the communal practice, even if you know there was some break and you know you don't live in your town in Europe where they didn't eat meat during the 9 days. It's already recorded in Shulchan Aruch. It's accepted by everybody. So when they came over to America, everybody continued doing this as well. It's bigger than a family minhag, and B, it is a local thing at this point even. But not everything is a real minhag. Some things you have to understand what has halachic significance. Like if you said, like if a woman says, so I was just thinking about this the other day, I was talking about the candle lighting. So a lot of women have the custom that they light the number of candles same number of candles as people in the family. So two you start out with two, because that's what it says in Zohar and Shom or whatever, but that's connected the husband and wife.
If you're a single person living alone, you would light two, because Zohar and Shom.
Right. Okay. Right. So, but then when you have children, so then you will add one candle per child. And you never go down. So the question is, technically, does a woman have to follow the minhag of her mother in terms of number of candles that she lights for Shabbos? So the answer really is no, because, I mean, she's certainly welcome to do so if she wants. If that's what she grew up with, that's nice. She's used to whatever, but it's not, strictly speaking, a minhag for the simple reason that this not everything that somebody does is a minhag. Let's say your mother, this is a method of honoring Shabbos. So lighting more candles is a greater honor of Shabbos. So your mother wanted to do this. But let's say another method that your mother honored Shabbos is that she prepared a 5-course meal every Friday night. You know, with new recipes every week and, you know, 2 types of meat and 2 types of chicken, 2 types of poultry and 2 types of fish. And, you know, so the daughter is also obligated to do this in honor of Shabbos just because her mother did that. Obviously not. That's part of her mother's choice of how she wanted to do things. So maybe her mother only had 2 kids and she has 12 kids. She doesn't have time to prepare a 5-course meal for every Shabbos.
So she could light 12 candles.
She doesn't. So I'm saying, so it's not technically. People think that your mother. I mean, it's very nice to maintain the traditions and do what your family did. But I'm saying, technically, halachically, not everything that your parent did is a minhag. That's actually, and again, even the idea that a family minhagim are binding on the next generation is questionable. We normally assume that they are to a certain degree, but what is considered a minhag is not so. Push it as what people might think it is. That's in addition with the candles that nowadays it could very well be argued that lighting more candles than the 2 is not an extra honor of Shabbos because nobody cares about the candles. Everybody who have electric lights. They don't actually add more light in honor of Shabbos. They look nice, but in terms of looking nice, why does the 5 really look nicer than 2? Well, okay, you can make...
It really gives you, like, wow, I have 5 kids. I'm like, 7 kids.
That's great. I didn't say it's us, sir. enjoy. I'm saying what's technically obligatory and what's not technically obligatory. So I think that's another reason since in the olden days, when you lit more candles, it was especially a greater honor of Shabbos because it was brighter in the house.
Yeah.
But nowadays, you have electric lights anyway, so there's less of a reason to light all the candles. Yeah?
A wise rabbi friend of mine says there's halacha, and there's minhag, and there's thing. And, like, some things are things, even though you think they're minhag. Minhag is serious.
Right.
I mean, you know, minhag is not just,
right.
It's only a minhag.
The Gemara the example gives is, in terms of family minhagim, what may be a family minhag. It's a shaila, I don't interpret the Gemara, but what may be a family minhag is that it says that technically, according to halacha, you're allowed to undertake a very short boat trip on Friday, even though it's shortly before Shabbos. It's reported that this family, maybe a certain family, would not undertake any boat trips on Friday because, obviously, of the potential problem of getting into Shabbos. So the Gemara seems to say over there that is binding, because this is something that this is al titosh Torah simecha. Don't reject the Torah of your mother because this is something that's really makes sense halachically. So something that there's really offense halachically that your family ancestrally, you know, passed down that is an extra zehirus, an extra care that we take. So that's the type of thing that might be binding, not what we were talking about before. But every situation is different. So again, I have to ask a shaila about each individual situation. Yeah,
there's never a problem if you go up, of course.
Right. Sure.
Right. Well, that's remarkable.
You mean if the...
If you become frugal and frugal.
Right, but that doesn't mean that the next generation could undo that. A person can always make the choice to be machmir, assuming it doesn't interfere with regular life functioning. You can make a choice to be machmir whatever you want.
Well, wait. So Aryeh goes from 3 hours to 6 hours in waiting.
Yeah.
His children can just say, ha ha, we're going to do what your parents did.
Absolutely obligated? I don't think so.
Yeah, Rosh Hashanah was actually very much against the 3 hours. In fact, it's reported they wouldn't give smicha anybody who kept 3 hours. Like
that. The reason for that is because it's brought down in Shulchan Aruch and the commentators that like a Talmid Chacham should keep 6 hours right. Even if ordinarily would.
You have to wish that on
so that's why you. But he didn't say, I don't think he paskin that all the women and, you know, everyone and less learned balabatim in the congregation have to keep 6 hours. Obviously not, since people still do it, but I think he just said, for people who have smicha, and maybe smicha, who are going to be spiritual leaders, you should keep the 6 hours. I think that was the that was the point. But I don't think it, the thing is, in terms of the way it's nowadays, that the standard, for better or for worse, now is six. That's why I would say it doesn't have to do with ancestral customs in particular in this case. It's just that since the standard is six, and normally people only keep 1 or 3 or whatever number of hours, if they have a specific tradition to do so, then that sort of abrogates the six. But the standard is six, so you shouldn't just switch from six to something else if you're already doing six. But if, I would say, you know, if you live in a community without a set tradition, mm-hmm. and you know that, let's say, your great-grandfather was, a real yekka, and he kept 3 hours, then your grandfather, his son wasn't frum, then your father became a baal tshuva mm-hmm. and kept 6 hours, and, oh, now I'm living in the middle of nowhere, what am I supposed to do? I don't think there's any problem in going back to three. If you didn't want to do so. Right. It's very complicated. There are no clear answers to these questions. There are no clear answers. So Rav Schechter commented many times that he says, well, Rabbi Simon sort of did this since then, but not exactly, I don't think, in the manner that he wanted, that he said that, what are people doing? You go to a Sfarim store, you find a 900-page book on how to answer Amen. What do you need that for? People should be writing Svarim about the real fundamental issues in halacha, like these things in Minhagim that have not been fully clarified.
Thank you.
All right, just finish up this mitzvah. V'yesa rubei pratei hashvuos v'inyan hetera, as we said, v'char k'zav v'yosim izah v'inyan mitzvah zo v'rachti v'shorsha mitzvah lo sisa seder v'yishma yisro. Again, we've in the Ten Commandments talking about shvuos more. V'noigis uzah v'chol makom v'chol zman b'zchar munikevos, males and females. The over aleph, if you violate it, imhaya mezid loke. Again, because shuas are more stringent than the regular av shein b'maisa. Bedavka be'edim v'asra, kemoshi yadua b'chol ha-mitzos, has to have witnesses and warning, v'im shogig chayev lavi korban ola v'yored. You bring an asham that changes price based on how rich you personally are. V'chein amrusham, in other words, it's either a bird or a meal offering or an animal, depending on your personal financial status. It says explicitly, it's not telling you anything really particularly interesting or new, it's just that it's just telling you that the korban changes prices. And you just want to point out one thing that the Minchas Chinuch says, which is, actually, two things, let's try to say very quickly. That one thing, he quotes the Mishnah Lamelech, who has a gigantic essay. Normally the Mishnah Lamelech is a commentary on the Rambam, he's just a few paragraphs on the side. So he has a gigantic essay in Hilchos Melachim about whether non-Jews are also obligated to keep their Shavuos on a Daraisa level. I mean, they should do it also ethically, but so he wants to bring a raya from the Avos. That may be because they took Shavuos, so maybe that is an indication that they do, even though it's not one of the official Shavuot Mitzvot B'nei Noach. And then, also, he points out that there's a concept of mufla samuch la'ish, which is that even before bar mitzvah, 1 year before bar mitzvah, your nedarim and shuas have a deraisa tokef. How do you say tokef in English? They work on a deraisa level even though you're not bar mitzvah yet. So, for example, if a girl is 11 or a boy is 12, so and that person takes neder shvua, so they don't, and they violate it right away during that year before bar mitzvah, so they don't receive the punishment because they're not bar mitzvah yet. But let's say you take a shvua, I will never do X, Y, and Z, and you do it during that time period, and then you violate it after bar mitzvah, so you receive the full penalty because the shvua, even though you wouldn't receive the punishment at that time in the year before bar mitzvah, since the shvua is completely chal, it worked, it took effect on a deraisa level, then you can be punished for it even after the bar mitzvah.